Welcome to the Voice of Family Business on Capitol Hill. It's great to have you with us. With each podcast from Family Enterprise USA, we bring you the latest news, expert opinions, and insights affecting the country's largest employer, the American family business. If you like this series, please remember to subscribe and sign up for the alerts as future shows are posted wherever you download your podcasts. In this episode of Voice of Family Business on Capitol Hill, host Pat Soldato of Family Enterprise USA talks with two prominent women who run generationally owned family businesses. The two guests are Katie Jeremiah, Chief Executive Officer, Aggregate Resource Industries, a rock drilling and blasting contractor that provides drilling and blasting services throughout the United States, and Petra Orueta, Executive Vice President, Blazer Industries, a family-owned and operated modular building manufacturing company.
So welcome, everyone. I'm Pat Soldano, President of Family Enterprise USA and Policy and Taxation Group. If you don't know who we are, we advocate for generationally owned family businesses and their lifetime of savings at a national level in Washington, D.C. We represent all sizes of business and all industries, small, medium, and large, and again, all industries in America. Today, we are here with Katie Jeremiah, who is CEO of Aggregate Resource Industries, a rock drilling and blasting contractor that provides drilling and blasting services throughout the United States. And we also have with us Pedra Orcetra, who is Executive Vice President, Blazer Industries, a family-owned and operated modular building manufacturing company. Blazer has grown steadily to become a leader and an innovator in the modular building industry and is based out of Almsville, Oregon. So today we're going to talk about these challenges and opportunities that women face in family-owned businesses, past, present, and future. And this is a second part in a series that we are doing on women-owned businesses, and there may be more in this series. So welcome, Katie. Welcome, Pedro.
Thank you. Thank you.
So let's get started and talk first of all with you giving us some background or history on the business. Tell us a little bit how the business was founded, when it was founded, the generations of the business, you know, the number of employees, where you're located, size, anything that you think would be interesting to our listeners. And Katie, why don't we start with you?
Okay. So Aggregate Resource Industries was founded in 1978, actually as BJ Equipment Company. It was founded by my father, Bob Jeremiah. Initially, he was involved in logging equipment sales of used equipment, and evolved. He was a serial entrepreneur. It evolved into selling explosives to the timber industry, to, you know, contacts that he had in that world, and then evolved into providing a full package service of drilling and blasting. And then in 1999, he passed away from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease, and the business transitioned. My mother and brother, Chris Jeremiah, Sandy Jeremiah, they ran the business until I came back in 2013. And now my brother Chris and I run it together. He is the president and I am the CEO. We are now 94 employees and work throughout the United States and provide drilling and blasting services for anything where you can't excavate things, excavate projects using traditional mechanical, say using an excavator. So we'll go in and pre-drill holes for large scale utility solar farms so that they can drive piles for the solar panel foundations. We'll blast out foundations for wind turbine projects, and in traditional mining projects, we just finished up a first phase at Thacker Pass, which is the largest lithium mine in North America, for Bechtel. And so we're just working throughout the United States in kind of a niche industry of drilling and blasting, where we can go in at scale and help with these large projects, data centers, large warehouse, kind of anything in the construction and mining realm.
So, and how many employees again?
So we're 94 employees right now.
And so when you and I chatted, we talked about, you didn't come directly into the family business. You went off to school and came in later. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I had attended Oregon State University and graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Construction Engineering Management and moved to San Diego after graduation and worked for a large general contractor there called DPR Construction. They're a national contractor that specializes in life science, biotech, and tech industry type construction. And I worked down there for 5 years. It was an amazing company, really amazing projects. A great team. A lot of the people that I worked with then are still there. It's really influenced a lot of the way that I've tried to run our family business. After working down there, I moved back to law school in 2006, and attended law school at Lewis and Clark Law in Portland, and graduated with a emphasis on business law and environmental law, and worked for a firm that specialized in construction law called Jordan Ramis, and represented mining contractors and construction industry businesses in everything from transactions, contracts, land use, and anything administrative, administrative defense in matters involving the Mine Safety Health Administration was kind of my niche specialty. And then in 2013, I became of counsel at that firm and actually moved back into the family business and relocated to Eugene, Oregon, and have been here ever since. And it feels like I've blinked since I've come back 11 years ago, and it's been a fun ride.
Well, so in your role with your brother, I think it's a good match, as we discussed briefly, because you have this law degree. So you handle one side of the business and he kind of handles the other. And so it seems to work pretty well, right?
It does. He has a tremendous expertise. His education was in mining engineering. And so he is really an expert at a subject matter expert in all of the mine planning and kind of logistics of the business. And so the way we split our roles is kind of what we call touch and non-touch. So he's doing all of the touch. So he's doing all of the business development, overseeing all the business development, estimating kind of the logistics of projects as far as just how to get projects executed, getting them properly staffed with the right teams and helping troubleshoot through issues. So he's really kind of the subject matter expert. And then my role is more of the non-touch back of house. So I'm overseeing all of the technology, all of the accounting, finance, insurance, any sort of legal. And then we kind of come together when it comes to larger scale decision making as far as, you know, acquisitions, land acquisitions, equipment acquisitions, kind of risk assessment on taking on new projects or new market sectors, kind of come together for those big picture decisions. And we've just come to a point where there's just a really great balance between the two of us. When I first came in the first year, it was a lot of working through that sibling dynamic of he's the older brother, I'm the younger sister, and trying to figure out, you know, are we a family business or a business family, and really professionalizing the business. And now that we've kind of worked through that, we find that the conflict that we have is really productive as far as coming to the best decision for the business, of coming from our kind of joint perspectives, where I have kind of more of a risk lens and he has more of an opportunity lens, and we can come together for the best path forward for the business.
Well, that's very interesting, and you certainly have found that good match between the two of you. So, Pedro, let's talk about your business, your family business, the background, the history, where you are generationally with the business.
Sure. So our business was started in 1976, and it was founded by my parents, Marv and Cheryl Shetler. Prior to that, they were involved in a portable toilet company that my grandfather, my mom's dad, actually owned. And so they had partnered with him at the end of his tenure there and started producing modular restroom buildings as a need for that portable toilet company, and added service that they or product that they could provide to their customers. And from there, it just morphed. It turned into mobile offices that you would see on a construction site, classrooms that you would see, portable classrooms for schools. And soon after, they sold the portable toilet company and just stayed in the modular industry. So since 1976, we've just grown steadily in the industry, and We're now one of the larger producers in the Pacific Northwest, and our focus still remains on the commercial market, but it has shifted from the smaller portable buildings to permanent, larger scale buildings that you wouldn't know that they're modular. So it's been a really fun industry, and it's been great to be part of that growth. We're now in our second generation. So in 2020, we transitioned from my parents' ownership to three siblings. So we work together. We all still retain ownership, but we are working together, the three of us, as partners. And I'm a little jealous of Katie having figured out some of those dynamics. That's where we're at right now. It's just really trying to figure out how to do this together. It's very difficult, but we're getting there.
Well, and how many employees again?
We have about 160.
Okay. But you're primarily located in the Northeast.
The Northwest. So we service really up and down the West Coast and Hawaii. Those are our primary markets, mainly due to transportation costs. It's cost prohibitive a lot of times to ship much further outside of our area.
And what are the other roles that your siblings do, or how do you define the three roles?
So our brother is engineering. So he has a degree in civil engineering. So he leads that department. And my sister takes on business development. And then my role is president currently. So we all have a little bit of a different path and have different strengths that we can bring to the table.
Okay. That's very interesting. So let's talk about kind of some of the unique challenges of women running women businesses, but not just women, but men businesses. And it's particularly, both of you are kind of in more male dominated industries, I would think. And we're finding that true more and more of women that not only run, but own businesses, family businesses. So maybe each of you could talk about what are some of the unique challenges or impediments that you face as a woman running your businesses. And Pedro, we'll start with you.
I would say there are less issues being a woman now. It was harder 20 years ago when there were far fewer in industry. It's definitely more acceptable. We're, I feel like we're looked at with that. We have actual knowledge now, whereas years ago, not so much. The difficulty that I face is just in the family dynamics of being the female in the family, you know, coming from, a family where, you know, the male and female have distinct roles. So that's been a big struggle on our end. But it's been refreshing to feel the growth in the industry as a whole in women leadership and just in the roles in the construction industry in general.
And Katie, how about you? What are the challenges you see as a woman in women and in your family business?
So I think I have to kind of rewind to, I would say, how I was raised in the industry. When I started my job with DPR Construction, I had some really amazing female mentors, and they really encouraged me to embrace the role of being a female in construction and to not have a chip on my shoulder that I needed to prove anything, to prove things through my work. And so I kind of learned to go into meetings and interactions with people just with being the person that could be the helper, kind of have that servant leadership mindset. And so through that, I earned quick trust with people that I wasn't there trying to set the stage as, being the person in charge because I needed to be the person in charge. And that has kind of followed through my legal career, and which was also very male dominated in construction law and into our business. And I would say the challenges present themselves only for the first impression. So it's the quick first meeting when people make lots of assumptions of what your role is, but then they quickly learn that, okay, you are the person that they need for the answers. And so I've had to grow some thick skin, I think, in those moments where there's just kind of a stereotype and a bias. And I admit that I'm guilty of it too. You know, I'll go to conferences and things like that, and you see a couple and you make the assumption that the man is the owner or the leader of the business. And mm-hmm. oftentimes it's not. And so I see that, that stereotype is, you know, out there, and it's just our role to just be a great contributor, I guess, and not really worry about the gender stereotypes. And so, but I think that initial confidence really came from, really amazing mentors that I had at DPR, a woman named Carrie Williams, and Deborah Beetson and Whitney Dorn. These women are absolute superstars in the construction industry, and they just set the tone for me that you can embrace being feminine, you can carry a purse and wear a dress, and it doesn't, that you can still be effective in your role. And so I feel like, especially in my legal career, it was really a differentiator for me of, it's easier, I think, for people to maybe remember you as far as your ability to market your companies because you're different. And so they have that tendency that you don't just blend in with the rest of the crowd of choices that people have when they're choosing contractors or service providers. And so, yeah, I just learned to have thick skin in the initial introductions and to be a good contributor and be a good partner to our customers. And then they just, it seems like the relationships grow stronger from there.
Well, that's really interesting. And you talked about the gender differences and the transitions that you've had to make throughout your careers. How about the transition of ownership? So we talk a lot about transition of leadership of the business, which is difficult. But transition of ownership is also difficult. And Pedro, you talked about that a little bit, but maybe you can both talk to us about how have you kind of weathered through or navigated the transitions, both in terms of leadership and ownership. And Katie, why don't we start with you?
So our family business, after my dad passed away in 1999, was owned by our mother, and she wasn't necessarily passionate about the business or construction, but she felt kind of an obligation to carry that opportunity so that when Chris and I were old enough to be able to take it over, that we would have that option. And so when it came to 2010, she wanted to transition ownership, and it was a very difficult decision for her because I was not operationally involved in the business. I had a board role as far as I was involved in understanding from a high level of what was going on. But Chris was really carrying the torch, working day in and day out in running the business. And so when she made the decision to transition ownership, ultimately ended up being a 50-50 split between Chris and I. And that caused some conflict because there wasn't a great understanding of the difference between ownership and operational involvement in the business. And so I think that there was some resentment on Chris's part and, you know, some anxiety on our mother's part of how that succession plan was set up. But in the end, now that I am operationally involved in the business and there's just such this great relationship, thankfully those waters have calmed. But it was really difficult. It was, you know, it's an emotional decision of handing over the business. There's just trying to get that fundamental understanding of, you know, the operational versus ownership participation in all of it. And I'm glad that we're through that that piece of it.
And Pedro, how about you? How have you done this transition of leadership and ownership?
So our parents were very much involved until we decided to transition, and it was a group discussion. There was not a one event that happened that forced us into this. It was just time. And so it was difficult for our parents to really figure out what they wanted to do next. And after almost 50 years of running a company, it's part of them. And so, you know, we had to navigate that and be conscious of how they felt. At the same time, we needed to make changes. And with that many employees, and we have a very family feel here, we were really conscious of reducing disruption, both to our employee base, but also our client base. You know, they'd gotten used to this our family and the way it was set up, the company. And so we didn't want to make massive changes right away, which is hard when you know there's so much that needs to change for the best, the betterment of the company. So I'd say we're still navigating that. We're just now starting to make changes to our team, but not really anything major. And I think it's really brought confidence and confidence in our leadership in the transition to take it over, and trust. It's built a lot of trust. So it's been an important avenue, route to take, I guess, for our transition, was to kind of really try to keep things as smooth as possible, and take the time we needed to make those big decisions.
Yeah, excellent. Well, sounds like you've both done a good job. It's never easy, but you're doing it, which is the most important part. And that's the most important step also, which a lot of families really have a difficult time doing. So as both of you know, Family Enterprise USA advocates for generationally owned family businesses in Washington, D.C. at a national level. And so we work on tax and economic issues and policies that affect your businesses, family businesses all over the United States. And so it would be helpful for us to know, how has tax policy, economic policy in this country helped or hurt your businesses as you've been attempting to grow them and build them in your communities? And so, Pedro, we'll start with you.
Probably the biggest issue with us is just regulatory issues specific to code compliance and energy code. You know, we are in the building industry, so, and we work with many states. So each state has its own program and requirements along with what's required federally. So we're constantly having to make sure that we're meeting all the requirements of both federal and state, and oftentimes local takes it another step. So for us, the biggest issue is just how often things change and how difficult it can be to navigate those changes, because a lot of times agencies, government agencies will make changes without a guideline on how to implement those changes. So it's up to us to really scramble and figure things out in an industry that moves pretty quickly. So that's probably our top issue in terms of the government.
And Katie, how about you?
From a tax policy perspective, I think I also share with Petra the challenges of the uncertainty and all of it and the ever moving goalposts. But I think so. Our business is extraordinarily capital intensive, lots of heavy equipment that we're constantly having to purchase. And so some of the tax policy, as far as like the Section 179 deductions, the bonus depreciation, those types of things are really important for us, but it makes it very challenging when it's in place and then it's being sunsetted and then they're pulling it back and we're not really sure what they're going to do. And so when we're trying to make investment decisions and budgeting decisions, that just becomes very, very challenging, especially with kind of some supply chain issues of knowing you want to get a certain piece of equipment in by the end of the year, but can you have it, you know, ready to be placed in service and, you know, physically delivered to you? And so there, it's just this constant dance, especially, you know, kind of October to the end of December of, you know, what levers are we going to pull? But just having, I think, some more certainty in that from a planning perspective would reduce a lot of those challenges. And then I don't know, do you want to get into the regulatory side of it as well now? Because I can answer a few of those too. The regulatory goalposts always moving are also really challenging. You know, one of the big pushes right now with all of the EV mandates, especially for large trucks, we're really challenged with that, because if they push to mandate that we have all of our large trucks electric, we don't have a power grid that can support that. You know, in order to get a truck just up and down the freeway, let alone into remote areas where we work, it's not physically possible. The infrastructure isn't there. And so it seems like a lot of times these triggers are pulled with good intentions. We don't disagree necessarily with the motives of for environment and employee health and those types of things, but the technology isn't necessarily there to support what the policies are that they're trying to put out and the regulations that they're imposing. And so, we've got a new mandate coming out under the Mine Safety Health Administration with regard to silica, and the industry just isn't really sure how that is supposed to be implemented in a way that we can still go out and perform the work. And you know, we are completely on board as far as employee health and taking those matters very seriously. But they put certain thresholds on that aren't necessarily achievable for people who have to work outside. And so trying to figure out whether we can actually even go in and bid work in certain mines is a real question right now of how that's going to be regulated. And so I think those are probably the biggest things is on the health and safety front, just ever changing regulations there, and the DOT type regulations. You know, there's challenges now with we haul explosives, and with the hazmat hauling, you have to have a TSA clearance for your drivers. Well, TSA is so incredibly backlogged that if your driver doesn't get in well before the deadline of the TSA clearance, you know, 60 days, maybe even 90 days in advance, if that TSA clearance doesn't get to the Department of Motor Vehicles to update the CDL, that driver completely has their entire, not just the hazmat endorsement, but the entire CDL is withdrawn and they don't have driving privileges. And that, you know, that is an example of regulation where the government can't keep up with the systems that they have in place to track it. And so it shuts down entire pieces of businesses because they can't haul because the government hasn't done their job yet. And so it's constantly a challenge of the implementation of ideologically, they're really great ideas, but they just don't fit with the industry. And then I'd say the last piece that's come up recently that's really challenging is there's a really great investment piece in the Inflation Reduction Act that's helping fund the utility scale solar projects. And so all of these projects are tied to Inflation Reduction Act funding that has a very specific apprenticeship requirement. You either have to have a registered apprenticeship, of which all of the registered apprenticeships are very far behind in processing and approving those, or you have to go and find an already existing apprenticeship where you can pull employees from. Well, we can't, our work is so niche that it's very hard to find an existing apprenticeship for rock drilling. The reason that we're out all the way, you know, to Washington, D.C. doing this work is because there aren't other contractors of our size that are capable of mobilizing at scale. And so contractors call us in to do these projects. They need us there in 3 days. Well, the Inflation Reduction Act says that we have to have a 45 days notice into these apprenticeships to see if they have people for us to come onto the projects. And if we don't do it, it's a $500 per hour, per labor hour fine for everyone that we have working for the duration of the project. So it's an incredibly huge gamble. And there's not clarity in the regulations of what do we do in this situation. If we can't get an apprenticeship approved on time, it's a new requirement. We can't get a hold of an apprenticeship that has labor to provide for us, but yet you have this threat of this $500 per labor hour fine that's completely cost prohibitive. We don't have that kind of money in the projects. And so it kind of puts customers and us at odds of who takes that risk. And it's just, you know, it's again, it's regulation that has good intent, but when it goes into executing projects, it makes it extraordinarily challenging.
Yeah, and you raise a really important point, is this constantly moving, no certainty, no permanency in our laws and our regulation make it so difficult to operate a business. And you really do, I'm glad you're both doing this because your voices really do need to be heard. And I'm hoping that both of you will consider coming to DC and sitting on the caucus panel either March 12th or May 14th or September 17th, because you both have great voices. And Pedro, you and I chatted and you talked about I asked you if you did any modular homes for homeless. And you had explained to me that you haven't done that yet, but that in your state, there was this opportunity for organizations to do that. And maybe you could talk about that a little bit in terms of the fund that was created and how difficult it is.
Yes. Well, we did we were awarded a grant through the state of Oregon to research and develop how to produce housing quickly, more quickly and more cost effective. So we are working on that right now. And we have just completed our first transitional housing village for Clackamas County. And some of the issues with that are there is a great need for that type of housing, but no regulations at all. And so it really puts us in a bind as to, well, first of all, how to price them because we don't know what the requirements are. And then second, just the process of who's approving what, who has the final say. And in this situation, part of the project was through the state of Oregon, like our normal buildings. And then part of it was through Clackamas County, who they're still navigating what they need and what their requirements are. And what we're finding is that every city has the same issues. There aren't requirements for that type of housing because if you follow the normal building code, then they're going to be too expensive. And we're going to be in the same position. You're not going to be able to produce the amount of housing that's needed. So this is a good case of we need some regulation, but the right type of regulation for that market and that need.
Yeah, and I think following on that from the transportation side, there's similar issues that, you know, we had a tremendous injection of funding into the transportation. And so people have in their minds of, oh, we're going to go out and build highways and, you know, restore rural transportation routes. But what's really happening, I think, is the funding is so tied up in all of these environmental studies and they can't get projects to the point of which you can put a shovel in the ground. And so the funding is not tied up in getting it out to providing jobs, getting infrastructure improved. It seems, you know, from my anecdotal perspective that it's just really tied up in red tape. And we've got to find a way to get projects going faster and eliminate that, you know, all of this basically opportunity to litigate whether the project should go forward or not. And find a balance so that we can get projects going.
And how about economic and tax policies that affect you individually as a business owner? You know, we work on things like 199A. I think both of you are pass-through entities, which should affect you. Income tax rates, again, if you're a pass-through entity, you're paying a higher income tax rate than regular corporations. And of course, there's the estate tax, which, as we know, families pay, individuals pay. Corporations don't pay. Have both of you wrestled with that? And do you have opinions about, you know, kind of what could be helpful to you? Go ahead, Jane.
Take that?
Oh. I don't have too much to say on it right now. We're just trying to navigate it.
I would say that we invest a lot in really smart tax accountants to help us through those things. I mean, just taxes generally as a pass-through entity are really challenging, especially in construction when things have a tendency to be pretty volatile from a cash standpoint, because, you know, you're basically taking a distribution to be able to pay your taxes. You're paying it in a year that's different than the year that you're that the taxes are incurred. And so you end up in a cash crunch in a year that might not be great to pay the taxes from the year before that were really great. And so it just it becomes a very challenging and very important to have an excellent team of advisors from a tax standpoint to navigate all that.
I would say it makes it more difficult for transition planning or for succession planning, really trying to figure out what to do specifically for our parents, you know, when to make that leap or take that leap to sell their shares or otherwise gift them. These are hard decisions and tax laws change. So what they planned 25 years ago is different from what they need to do today.
Well, that's very, very helpful and will be helpful to us when we meet with members of Congress. Let's wrap this up with kind of the final question. We found that family businesses really support their community more than non-family businesses. In fact, over 70% give locally. So there's a huge impact if that business goes away because it doesn't, you know, it has to close its doors for whatever reason. Maybe both of you could share a little bit with, you know, how do you support your local communities? So, Pedro, we can start with you.
Yes, it's very important for us. That's one of the reasons that we remain a privately held family business, is we really value our employee base and our community. And we know that we would be, it would make a huge impact if we were to sell our company, and also if we were to move outside of our community. This is our second location. So we originated in Silverton, which is also a small town, not as small as Almsville, but it will make a big impact if we were to make a change. And we do work hard to support our local vendors in our surrounding communities as much as possible. It's not always feasible or an option. We support different programs, schools, YMCA, different programs that not only affect our workforce, but just our community in general. So we do value that.
Katie?
So we actually launched a purpose statement for our business last year, and it says we exist to shape the future. And that goes just to the physical landscapes of where we're working with the drilling and blasting and all of the utility scale renewable projects and data centers and all those types of things. But really it's about shaping the future of the communities that we work in. So my dad, who is the founder of the business, he really attributed his success to the mentors that he had. He grew up in somewhat of a difficult upbringing, and he attributed his success in sports and in the military and in, you know, everything that he did to coaches and mentors that he had and to sports generally. And so really our kind of giving focus in our communities are really about opportunities for kids to kind of have a second chance through sports, through really great mentorship. So there's an organization called Friends of the Children. It's now a national organization, but it's founded in Portland, Oregon, that we're a large supporter of. Organizations that are kind of similar to Boys and Girls Club, any of the kind of local booster clubs in the communities in where we work, and just really trying to make sure that youth have opportunities and, you know, scholarship programs in schools that emphasize awarding recipients that participate in sports, multi-sport athletes, things like that. And so it's really very core to what we do of the philanthropy of sharing and giving back to our community.
Well, that is fascinating, and I really, really appreciate what you do for your communities. Again, that's what we have found most family businesses do. So I want to thank both of you for being on this podcast today. It's been really fascinating for me personally, and I know for our listeners. So thanks for your time, and thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So we hope you liked today's show, and if you did, please subscribe to our podcast, where each episode discusses the critical issues affecting generationally owned family businesses and their lifetime of savings, family offices, and successful individuals around the world. You can find this podcast wherever you download your podcasts. Until next time, thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this week's Family Enterprise USA podcast. This is the only series devoted exclusively to the critical issues facing America's family businesses, the families that own them, and the clients of family offices. We hope you liked this episode. Please make sure to subscribe and tell others about our podcast. Having your voice heard in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country can make a difference. We look forward to having you listen in next time.